Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The Democratic gubernatorial race picked up another candidate this week, former state senator Peter Galbraith. There are now three candidates in the race. Galbraith, former Transportation Secretary Sue Minter, and former state senator Matt Dunn. Galbraith says he hopes to shake things up in this contest, and he's backing what he calls a progressive agenda for the future of Vermont. Retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis says Galbraith's message could find a fair amount of support within the Democratic Party.
So if there were another candidate who got into the gubernatorial primary, making an argument for a more explicit progressive set of policies, single payer in health care, a more redistributive tax system, look seriously at the state social programs and who is benefiting for them, and some of the ideas that the so-called moral economy campaigners have been talking about in recent months, I think there's room for a candidate with that message in the Democratic primary.
What are the issues that Peter Galbraith wants to raise in this year's race? That's one of the questions we have for our guest today, former Windham County Senator Peter Galbraith. Senator, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Bob.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. What are your thoughts about this year's race for governor? What are some of the most important issues that the candidate should be addressing? And are they? Is state government doing a good job responding to the needs of Vermonters? 1-800-639-2211. Your thoughts about this year's race and the top priorities that you think the gubernatorial candidate should be looking at. Senator, I think there are a lot of people who are wondering. We've already got two candidates in the Democratic gubernatorial race. So what are the key factors that are motivating you to get into this contest?
Well, first, Bob, the fact that some people chose to get into the race last summer doesn't mean that there isn't room for an additional candidates. I mean, I have repeatedly said I don't believe we should be having 18-month campaigns in Vermont for a 24-month job. But the other reason I got in is, frankly, the existing candidates are not talking about the issues that concern me, and I think many Vermonters. And these are issues of economic justice, of income inequality. And so that's really at the center of what I'm going to run for. I'm going to run for a higher minimum wage, which is, in my view, the single most important thing that we can do to make Vermont affordable. The Republicans talk about an affordability crisis, and then they propose to limit budget increases. But affordable for whom? The people who would be affected by more government spending are people who are at the top of the tax brackets. Vermont's perfectly affordable for them. The people at the bottom who are working 40 hours a week at minimum wage, yes, Vermont is not affordable for them. And the way to make Vermont affordable for them is to increase the minimum wage. So I propose going to $12.50 immediately and to $15 in increments. Incidentally, it would be also very good for our state economy because low-wage workers spend virtually all their extra money, and they spend it locally. And it would be actually good even for wealthier taxpayers, because right now taxpayers are subsidizing low-wage employers, including some of our wealthiest corporations. That's because in order for these low-wage employees to survive, they end up getting all sorts of government assistance, food stamps, earned income tax credit, and the like. If they made more, they wouldn't need public assistance.
I can almost hear members of the small business community right now saying this kind of proposal will result in the loss of hundreds of jobs all across the state because these small businesses cannot afford to offer that kind of minimum wage.
Yes, I'm sure that argument will be advanced. But I think the larger issue is the tens of thousands of Vermonters who are working at the minimum wage. And remember, most of these minimum wage jobs can't move out of state. You can't flip a hamburger in Brattleboro from Hinsdale, New Hampshire. You can't load somebody onto a ski lift at Stowe from New Hampshire. So raising the minimum wage is going to help a large number of Vermonters. It actually put more money into the economy. And I think businesses will discover that it turns out to be to their advantage. In fact, there is an example. New Jersey some years ago raised the minimum wage. Pennsylvania right across the border did not. The prediction was somehow New Jersey would lose jobs, but just the opposite happened. Jobs grew in New Jersey and not so fast in Pennsylvania.
Do you think there's also a need to take a look at and perhaps reform Vermont's tax code, both for individuals and for businesses?
Absolutely. We have a tax code that is riddled with special interest deductions and tax breaks. And the legislature just can't resist adding to them. In this last session, for example, they've gone ahead and exempted cloud computing companies from the sales tax. That's going to cost $4 million a year in revenue. The argument is that this will help make Vermont a technology hub. This is a growing industry. Well, of course, the cloud computing lobbyists are going to every state making exactly that argument. Not everybody's going to be able to become a technology hub. But meanwhile, it transfers $4 million to every other taxpayer. And increasingly, people feel that the tax system is unfair. We allow in Vermont people to deduct mortgages on homes that are not in the state. In fact, to deduct the interest on mortgages that are not even in the country. What is the policy interest in permitting that?
Today in the program, our guest is the newest member of the Democratic gubernatorial race, former State Senator Peter Galbraith. Your thoughts, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Let's start off with Casey in Plainfield. Hi, Casey. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because healthcare is unaffordable. Even with insurance, I end up putting off care because the out-of-pocket costs are just too expensive. I understand you want to reinvigorate the universal healthcare conversation, but how do you plan to get there given the numbers that came out at the end of 2014? What's your vision?
Well, Casey, when Act 48 was before the legislature in 2011, I said, I'm for universal health care, but I think we also ought to have the method for paying for it in the same piece of legislation. Well, as you know, that was put off to 2013, 2014, and then dropped. So what I'm proposing now is that we go toward that same goal, but incrementally. And there are a couple of ways to do this. When I was in the Senate, I proposed that we create a public option on the Vermont Health Connect Exchange, which would be subsidized. And so that would make the insurance more affordable for everybody. In fact, it would tend to bring everybody toward a single-payer system because you would always choose the public option rather than the other ones because it would both provide better coverage and it would be subsidized. Another idea that I go look at is that we would have universal, publicly financed primary care. And the reason for doing that is that when people come to get primary care, they get treatment sooner, and then their insurance costs would be somewhat less because they would only have to insure for things other than primary care. And over time, if they get early and care and preventable care, the out-year costs would be less. So it would be a savings for the system. But I think this is a fight worth continuing. I should point out that I was the only person to offer legislation to actually pay for universal publicly financed health care in Vermont.
Senator, as Casey pointed out, Governor Shumlin was a strong supporter of single payer, but then announced late in 2014 after the election that the numbers just didn't add up. It was going to require a payroll tax of between 10% and 12% on most employers, probably a payroll tax of between 4% and 6% for most employees. And he said it just wasn't feasible. If he couldn't succeed with this, how can you?
Well, Bob, what I'm talking about is proceeding incrementally toward this goal, which is to have a public option on the exchange For example, the legislation I offered in the Senate would have said that if you got a silver plan under the public option, if you went for that because that plan gets federal subsidies according to your income, you would actually receive the benefit of a gold. And beyond that, there would be a $40 a month subsidy for each individual or $120 per family. And this could be financed with a 2.2% payroll tax. So I think there are ways that we can advance toward the goal of universal publicly financed health care at this point in time. I think we could have done it in 2011. It couldn't have. I mean, one of the problems with the figures that Governor Shumlin came up with is that he had a very, very expensive plan, and he included people that didn't need to be included. For example, there was really no point in including Medicare recipients because they already have government-financed health care. There wasn't any point including federal employees or military because they, too, have government-financed health care. And incidentally, you can't even tax the federal government with a payroll tax.
So some people are listening who are going to say, you know, what the crisis the state is facing is how to control health care costs, because if you don't control health care costs, it almost doesn't matter how you pay for it because you're going to go bankrupt. How would your proposal help control costs?
Well, I think that we need to proceed with the health care cost containment proposals that we have. But if you look at the idea of universal universal publicly financed primary care, one of the advantages of doing that is that you get doctors away from being involved in billing. And just the time spent on billing for a primary care doctor, because, of course, he's going to have to bill for having taken the blood pressure and for having done this or that procedure, lab tests. If he can simply, he or she can simply devote her or his time to the patient, then, in fact, you increase the amount of time that they can spend seeing patients by 25% or 33%. That increases your health care resources. And if people get primary care and preventive care, then the much more expensive procedures are less needed and we can save money.
Let's go back to our callers. A number of people would like to talk to you this afternoon. And let's start off with Brian in North Ferrisburg. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. My concern is that if we raise the minimum wage, which I am all for, to $12.50 an hour and up, will that price people out? Will their income become so high that they do not qualify for the social network safety net that keeps people in food stamps and, you know, HEAP and all these efforts to help the poor survive? $12.50 an hour just doesn't seem high enough, in my opinion.
Well, Brian, that's a very good question. I think the basic point is if you work 40 hours a week, you should earn enough so that you do not need public assistance. And that public assistance really represents a subsidy by all the other taxpayers to the employer who is paying that low wage. Now, what you want to be careful as you move to $12.50 initially is that you don't have people fall off the benefit cliff. So you have to make sure that the benefits are declining rather than just ending because you cross a certain threshold. And my proposal is not just to stop at $12.50, it's to go to $12.50 immediately. That represents a more than 25% increase in the current minimum wage, and then in stages to $15. Basically, this is doing in Vermont what Bernie Sanders is proposing nationwide.
Today on the program, our guest is Democratic gubernatorial candidate Peter Galbraith. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Peter Galbraith. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. We've been talking about health care, raising the minimum wage. In a little while, we'll be talking about energy and the role of towns in deciding whether or not projects should be sited in their community. But your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Erica in Plainfield. Hi, Erica. What's on your mind today?
Hi there. I just have two interrelated questions, and one is about broadband. Some people are greatly disadvantaged by the lack of decent internet, you know, at a time when it's not really optional any longer, and it affects people's ability to, you know, it affects Vermont's ability to attract and keep young people as well as small businesses. And I might add that we currently have Fairpoint, which I think has received, correct me if I'm wrong, has received substantial subsidies from the state of Vermont. And our service is currently out. We asked to upgrade a couple days ago, and since that time, we have had no internet service, and they said, you know, maybe Monday, maybe Tuesday, maybe Wednesday, and it just seems like a fairly serious issue. And sort of interrelated to that would be, you know, Public Service Board, oversight of this type of thing. I'm not really sure how to approach that question, except, you know, recently they did a big self-assessment, and I just wondered who thought that it was a good idea for them to do a self-assessment. But I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Erica. Senator, there are a lot of people very frustrated by the lack of broadband in this state. What are you going to do about it?
Erica, Bob, I'm one of those people. And because I do not have broadband at my home.
Really?
I do not. There's nothing I can do to get it, nor actually at my office, which is up the hill. So I have to use a satellite up there, which is not nearly good enough for the needs that I have. But what is worse about it, what makes my blood boil, to be honest, is the lack of honesty about the situation. Recently, the Governor Shumlin said that there were only three E911 addresses in Vermont that did not have broadband or did not have a solution for them. Well, I happen to have three E911 addresses on my property, and that there is no broadband, there's no solution, and I know that those are not the only three E911 addresses in the state of Vermont. In fact, when I was in the Senate, I put forward an amendment that said let's have a truthful report about where we're going to have broadband. That was defeated, but the first step is at least to be honest about where we're going to have broadband. Maybe there's some places that we can't have it, but I certainly believe that this is a bit of vital infrastructure. It needs to get everywhere. It's in the 21st century. This is what people need in a way that they needed electricity. You know, in the early part of the 20th century, but it's vital for our economic development and certainly for the vitality of our more rural areas. You think about why would somebody want to do business in Vermont? Well, you know, the Republicans say, well, we have high taxes, expensive labor. The answer is it's a great place to live. Recreational opportunities, good schools, a healthy estate, low crime. We have a sense of community. We care about each other. And so people do come here. They do open businesses. But, of course, they need to have the infrastructure of the 21st century, and that means getting broadband out to everybody.
Let's talk about renewable energy, both wind and solar projects. I think you've called for a moratorium on future industrial wind projects in Vermont. Is that the case, and if so, why?
I have called for a ban on future industrial wind projects in Vermont. I think global warming is the most serious long-term problem that our planet faces. But that does not mean every proposed solution makes sense. The trouble with the ridgeline wind projects is that they are located in what are environmentally the most sensitive places in the state, the most pristine places. And in fact, places where, as the environment adjusts to global warming, wildlife will need to use as corridors to move. And when we put, it's not just the turbines, but greater damage comes from the very large roads that have to go up there. And what do they produce? They produce intermittent power, and it's not actually even clean power, because the utilities then sell the RECs, renewable energy credits, out of state, and that enables industries and utilities in other states to continue to burn fossil fuels. This does not make sense.
And how about solar projects? Do you think that individual towns should essentially have veto power over proposed solar installations within their communities?
I support the development of solar in Vermont, but I think it should be done in accordance with town plans. That's really our tradition. And there are plenty of places where solar is appropriate, many of them not taken up by the solar companies, but there are lots of rooftops. There are big stores, all sorts of landfills that nobody objects to the location of solar panels in these places. But I think we need to have solar, but I don't think we should just override the desires of Vermont towns.
So if a Vermont town has certain zoning ordinances for solar projects, do you think that should be the final word?
Barring some extraordinary reason otherwise, yes. But I think towns also should be encouraged to set aside areas that would be appropriate for solar development. But the Public Service Board shouldn't just come in and take an area, prime agricultural land, an area that is part of the scenic values of the town, and just say, well, this is where a large solar development should go, when it's opposed by the people of the town.
So, you know, there are a number of backers in Vermont of renewable energy who say that your proposals will totally undermine the state's goal of having 50% of its power come from renewable sources by 2050, and that you're undermining the entire renewable energy effort. What do you say to those folks?
I support responsible renewable energy, but I think we really ought to focus on the place where we can make the biggest difference in terms of the climate, and that is efficiency and conservation. Dollar for dollar, efficiency and conservation are the most effective way to combat global climate change in Vermont, to combat global warming. But we don't make an appropriate investment in it. Why? Utilities do not make money for the kilowatt that's not generated.
Let's go back to our callers and speak with John, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to address your stance on the ban on the wind power, the industrial wind power. And I do understand that some people feel it's on the ridgelines and it's not aesthetically pleasing, etc. But it's renewable. It is a renewable source of energy. Wind is always there. And I don't think they're that hard to look at. I travel out to Malone, New York, quite often, and right through that area, there's a large wind farm that actually I see it, and I think it's kind of neat looking. And it is, once again, power, and they're generating local renewable power. Just doesn't make sense to me why we would, in Vermont, very environmentally, air pollution free state, would want to generate more fossil fuel energy. I'll take my response off air.
John, the main source of renewable energy in Vermont for our electricity is hydro, and that doesn't produce any of the pollution that fossil fuels do. The problem with wind is that it is actually destructive of the ecosystems where the towers are located. That these ridge lines are among the most pristine areas in our state. They're rich in wildlife, and including some species that really don't exist anyplace else. There's also an issue of economic justice here. Because what you have is these large corporations, some of them who are foreign, who are locating these projects in the poorest and remotest part of the state. If you Google the 10 poorest towns in the state of Vermont, you'll see that four of them are places that either have these projects or where they've been proposed. And these are the places that don't want them, that are least able to fight back. And I don't think that's right. I think we ought to respect the wishes of the local community. Everybody's for these projects when they're someplace else. But when they come into their own neighborhood, then they're not. And I think we ought to, you know, it's the Vermont way to really respect what our local communities want.
Let's talk to George in Brattleboro. Hey, George, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Wanted to change the subject a little bit. Brattleboro is a hub town. We have the infrastructure to support a large economic area outside of town. I think White River Junction, Bennington, all face similar problems. The taxpayers in the town of Brattleboro have to pay for services well beyond the folks who live in Brattleboro. Any ideas from somebody who wants to be governor on how this could be improved?
George, I'm of course very familiar with this issue from the time that I represented Brattleboro in the Vermont Senate. I think this is something that we need to look at. I think part of the solution might be to have a more fair tax code. What I'd like to see is get rid of the special interest tax breaks, the deductions that don't mean very much. I'm not against raising the income tax on the highest earners. And if we do that, we can put money into the education fund, reduce the reliance on the property tax to fund education, and that would bring some reduction property tax, not just to hub towns, but to property owners across the state of Vermont.
Senator, there's a proposal at the State House that its backers hope will be studied over the course of the summer that essentially says that all Vermont households would pay for education based on a percentage of their income, and that someone making $50,000 a year would pay the same percentage of their income as someone making $500,000 a year. Do you support that approach?
I'm familiar with the proposal, and I support the idea of shifting some of the cost of education away from the property tax to the income tax and to other taxes. Indeed, if I were to design a system for financing education from the scratch, I probably wouldn't use the property tax at all. Property tax ought to be used for property-related issues, but that's not where we are now. I think if we do shift more to an income tax-based system, it ought not to be just a flat tax. I think our tax system ought to be progressive. Those who earn more, who have more, I think it's not unreasonable to ask them to pay more.
Let's talk to Mary in Windsor. Hi, Mary. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Senator Galbraith, you've done an outstanding job in Windham County, and I'm hoping that you'll continue to do so if you get to be governor. I'm interested in whether or not you will propose a paid maternity leave for Vermont families, which would then impact the school districts, which they're trying to unify and consolidate because it's too expensive to have children. And I'm interested in your response on that.
Mary, I have to point out that in large parts of the industrial world, paid parental leave, not just maternity leave, but also some time for new fathers, is standard. And so I think that is a principle that we should be for. It is difficult to implement in a single state. Although it certainly could be done for public employees, this is something that I agree with in principle. I think the my immediate focus, however, is going to be on trying to increase the minimum wage, because I think that is the thing more than anything else that will make our state affordable for a very large number of Vermonters. And of course, when you raise the minimum wage for those who are working at the minimum wage, you inevitably have wage increases all the way up chain. So it's something that would raise all boats. But In principle, I share your point.
Senator, I wanted to ask you about an ethics commission in Vermont. Vermont's one of the very few states in the country that does not have an ethics commission in place. Lawmakers are now looking at a very scaled-down version of a bill that was introduced earlier. That original bill had an executive director, several people on the staff. They were going to investigate allegations that were made to the commission. It was going to cost roughly $600,000. The new scaled-back version has a half-time director who will not investigate allegations of wrongdoing. Does Vermont need a full-time ethics commission?
Bob, I don't know. To me, the larger problem in Vermont is the way in which the special interests prevail over the broader public interest so many times. And I think the root of that problem is in part the way we finance our campaigns. We allow corporations to contribute directly to political candidates in Vermont, something that is prohibited in many states, even a state like Texas, and that has been banned under federal law since 1907. I tried as a senator to get that to ban these contributions. Of course, Vermont politicians love to rail how much they hate corporate money in politics, but when it comes to themselves, there's always that outstretched hand. But what happens is it's not incidentally that corporations are trying to buy influence. It's simply that when a politician comes to a corporation or a lobbyist and asks for a campaign contribution, the corporation or the lobbyist is afraid not to give because they don't want to have their they always want to keep the door open. They don't want to have any possible retaliation. And politicians then trim their own positions to try to accommodate the places where they're getting the money. So in terms of what is a larger problem, I would even say a kind of corruption, it is the way in which we finance our campaigns. It's the role of the lobbyists in Montpelier. The Ethics Commission is dealing with a much smaller part of the problem.
So what's the size of your budget? How much money do you think you're going to need to spend in order to win the Democratic nomination?
Bob, I think I'll be able to raise enough money to be competitive. But elections in Vermont are not won by money. Once you have a credible candidate, and I think I am a credible candidate in this race, I think it's going to be a matter of ideas. And elections really are about choices. And so if Vermonters want to have a higher minimum wage, then I'm going to be their choice. If they want a tax code that eliminates all the special interest tax breaks and deductions that don't make sense, I'm the only candidate doing that. If they want to get rid of corporate campaign contributions, I'm the person who's led the fight on it. If they would like to expand health care, I'm the only person who offered financing for our single-payer system, and I have specific plans, incidentally, in the form, which were also in bills that I offered in the legislature, to continue incrementally the fight for universal health care. And if you're concerned about the destruction of Vermont's ridgelines, I'm the only candidate against that. Now, this is a choice, and voters can make that choice. And if they like what I'm saying, then I hope they'll vote for me. And of course, if they don't like it, well, that's democracy.
Senator, we got just a minute left. What are your thoughts about legalizing marijuana?
I'm in favor of legalizing marijuana. I have some concerns about the bill that is pending in the legislature. First, if marijuana is going to be a legal product, then it seems to me Vermonters ought to be able to grow it themselves for their own personal consumption. And I want to make sure that in the process of legalization that we that the product is safe, that it is kept out of the hands of minors. But I'm not sure that we need to have a licensing system that restricts the number of licensees, provided we can meet those criteria of making sure they're unadulterated product and that it's kept out of the hands of minors.
And how about things like driving while impaired? Does something need to be done there?
Well, legalization really has nothing to do with driving while impaired, because there are many Vermonters who already consume marijuana. We need to have a system for detecting people who are under the influence of all drugs. And, of course, that is an offense, and it should be prosecuted.
Former State Senator Peter Galbraith, many thanks for being on the program today. We look forward to covering this race in the coming months.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Coming up next, I'll talk with 7 Days reporter Paul Heintz about the state of Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. This was a pretty good week for Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. He overwhelmingly won caucuses in Utah and Idaho, and he had some impressive fundraising totals. So where does this campaign stand at this point? We turn to 7 Days political reporter Paul Heintz for some answers. Hey, Paul.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
So, Paul, in a recent conference call, Sanders campaign manager Jeff Weaver told reporters that he sees a clear path for Sanders to win the Democratic nomination. He said it was, quote, halftime in this race, and that the second half has a number of states that could be very favorable for Sanders. So how do you view this race right now?
Well, you know, I think Mr. Weaver has a point. A lot of the early states in this race leaned more towards Hillary Clinton's advantages. She tends to do well in southern states and states that have a higher percentage of African-American voters. Those are just places that Bernie Sanders has not really made significant inroads. So if you look at the states ahead of us, there is no doubt that they are better for Sanders than they are for Clinton. At the same time, the delegate math does not look good for him. That's the reality of the situation. Right now, Hillary Clinton has a 303 pledged delegate lead. And once you throw those superdelegates in there, she's got a 744 delegate lead. And if you really look closely at the math, it would be extraordinarily difficult for Sanders to make up the deficit that he has right now. Most people think that he would have to win around 60% of all of the remaining delegates just to get even among the pledged delegates. And then we're not even taking into consideration the superdelegates.
And that's because the Democrats use proportional voting.
That's right. Unlike the Republicans, who use winner-take-all in some of their states, the Democrats use proportional voting throughout the process. In a way, that is good for Sanders because, you know, even when he doesn't win a state, he can pick up a certain percentage of delegates. But it's much harder to really change the game. You know, he can't just go in there and win one or two big states by a couple of percentage points and then take all the delegates. He basically needs to perform really well in every state going forward.
So this weekend, 3 more states will hold caucuses: Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington. The Sanders campaign thinks it's going to do very well in all 3 states. Now, if that happens, does that give Sanders some much-needed momentum heading into April?
You know, theoretically, winning states is important because it gets you headlines, right? I mean, that's sort of the end result of that. But this is a delegate contest. So the question is he going to win 60%? Is he going to win 70% of the delegates this weekend? He really needs to make that kind of margin. The contests that came earlier this week are a very good example of this. He did tremendously well in Idaho and Utah. He won about 80% of the vote there. Hillary Clinton did much better in Arizona, and that's a far bigger state. So in the end, he won about 57% of the delegates on Tuesday. And that simply isn't enough to make up the deficit.
That really points up the problem that he faces going forward.
Exactly. And so, you know, he's looking ahead at some of the big remaining states like California and New York, where he thinks he can do well. But he's going to have to do just tremendously well there.
And New York will come after Wisconsin. Wisconsin, the Sanders campaign thinks it can do very well there. And New York, what a big, expensive contest that could be.
It really is. I mean, think about how different that is from running in Iowa, you know, especially when you've got 6 months to get your operation going in Iowa. You know, New York has 291 delegates on the line. So that gives you a sense of it. And then if you go even further ahead, June 7th, which is the last real day of this race, California has 546 delegates on the line. So surely, you know, if he won every last one of those delegates in New York and California, he'd be doing great. But it's hard to see that happening.
So do you think Sanders will stay in the race right through the California primary?
Well, you know, I don't think there's any reason for him to get out right now. Whether or not he can actually realistically win this thing, the fact is he's still raising a lot of money. Therefore, he can keep funding this operation. And he's getting out there in front of people. He's speaking to massive crowds. You know, he's still still filling these arenas. And, you know, Bernie Sanders has always said, he's always been very clear that he wants to spread this message. He's got a very core message about economic inequality, about climate change, about campaign finance reform, and he wants to spread that message across the country. What better way is there than to run for president and to have, you know, the National Press Corps following your every move? So I don't think it really would make sense for him to drop out at this point. The fact is he's still picking up delegates, and when he gets to the Democratic convention this summer, he'll have a lot of power at that point.
Well, let's say just hypothetically that he doesn't win and he ends up with maybe 40% of the delegates and Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee. What kind of role would Sanders play at the Democratic convention?
Well, that remains to be seen, and he and his campaign are not going that far at this point. You know, I think ultimately Bernie Sanders is going to be a team player. He has always looked back at the 2000 election and at what Ralph Nader did to split the liberal vote, and that's just not his style. So I think eventually you're going to see him coming around, assuming that Hillary Clinton does win. He's going to come around. He's going to be very supportive. But he may try to exact some kind of concessions. What those are, I don't know, whether that's a, you know, primetime speaking slot at this convention or certain policy platforms or certain commitments from Hillary Clinton. We'll see. But I think he'll have a little bit of leverage there.
You mentioned his fundraising. You know, we learned that in February, Sanders raised $43 million compared to Clinton's $30 million. And Sanders' average contribution is roughly $30. So it gives him a really strong financial base going forward because he can go back to many of these contributors again.
That's right. And one of the most fascinating things about this campaign is, win or lose, every time there's an election, there's another influx of money to his campaign from his very loyal supporters. At a certain point, those contributions might dry up. But unlike a more traditionally funded campaign, he doesn't need to prove to, you know, millionaires and billionaires that he's viable. He just needs to excite the grassroots, and he continues to do that for sure.
Let's switch gears and look at some recent developments in the Democratic gubernatorial race here in Vermont. This week, former state Senator Peter Galbraith announced that he would be a candidate for governor. We just heard him outline some of his priorities for the campaign. Now, we already have two candidates in this race, former Transportation Secretary Sue Minter and former state Senator Matt Dunn. They've both raised a fair amount of money, close to $500,000 at this point. So how does Galbraith's candidacy affect the dynamics of this race?
Well, you know, Peter Galbraith is a very savvy politician. He's extraordinarily intelligent. And I think he will really rock this debate, will rock this race. You know, one question is whether he will be able to raise sufficient resources to compete. Many of the top Democratic donors are locked up at this point in the state, and he says that he will not entirely self-fund his campaign. But, you know, he could wage a less expensive campaign and still get his message across and do quite well.
Now, he says he wants to be a, quote, progressive with a small p voice in this race. This means backing a single-payer health care system. It means $12 an hour minimum wage immediately, a ban on industrial wind turbines. Are we going to see a real difference in positions between Galbraith and perhaps Dunn and Minter?
Clearly, he wants to show some serious differences there. I think the most interesting issue in this race is wind. So on most of the other issues that he talks about, he is to the left. But on renewable energy, he's taking a position that I think many Democrats disagree with. And I'm curious how that will play out.
Also, some news in the possible Republican race for the U.S. Senate this week. The party's gubernatorial candidate in 2014, Scott Milne, strongly hinting that he might run against Senator Patrick Leahy. How likely is that?
Well, if you remember 2 years ago, I believe it was just hours before the filing deadline that Scott Milne got into the race to challenge Governor Shumlin. You know, he did extraordinarily well during that contest. He nearly beat the incumbent governor, something that, just does not happen in this state. But this would be a very different race. Governor Shumlin was pretty unpopular at the time that he faced re-election, and Senator Leahy has about 65% approval rating. And so the other dynamic, I think, is that, you know, Vermonters tend to be more interested in sending Republicans to the governor's office, but not to Congress. And so I think that would be a challenge for Scott Millen if he were to get into the race.
A lot of interesting developments in campaign 2016 here in Vermont. 7 Days political reporter Paul Heinz, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you, Bob.
That's it for today. We learned this week that a water contamination problem in private wells in North Bennington is also affecting municipal water in Pownall. Monday on Vermont Edition, we'll get an update about what we know about the suspected carcinogen, PFOA. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sungari and Sam Gale Rosen. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.